All right, everybody, shalom and welcome to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are. Shalom and welcome to beautiful Yerushalayim and the Land of Israel Network. As I look out from Yeshivat Pardes, I see a crane outside of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is being built. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is happening in our time, and you're a part of it. Thank you so much for joining us. As I started saying, I'm at Pardes. That means it's time for a spiritual cafe with Rabbi Mike Foyer. Rabbi Mike, shalom and welcome.
Oh, it's so great to see you, Chai.
It is great to see you. It is great to see you. And we recorded early last week. That means that we haven't seen each other in a while. It's great to see you. I'm very excited to study with you the Torah portion of Toldot. I was thinking about how oftentimes I say, like, this is one of my favorite Torah portions. The truth is, this is not one of my favorite Torah portions in a weird way. But it is one that's very entertaining and complex. And when I say it's not one of my favorites, God forbid, do not understand me. The Torah is equal. Every word of it is exactly equal to another word. Every letter is equal to the other word. And there's so many lessons here. But what I was thinking when I was thinking about saying this to you, I was thinking, why is that? And that's because this is the Torah portion that I would say is the beginning of conflict. The truth is, every single Torah portion has had conflict. Every single one. If it's Bereshit, that God was upset with the world itself, and the Adam and Eve, that whole issue, and then of course the Noah and the destruction of the world, and the Tower of Babel. We've had conflict in Lech Lecha with the kings, and Abraham's coming, and he's leaving his father. We've had conflict everywhere, but all those conflicts have been, and we also of course had a not very revealed conflict between Ishmael and Yitzchak, but it wasn't very revealed to us in the text. It was lighter, okay? Lighter. In this Torah portion, we begin an intra-family conflict. And we're going to begin the story of Jacob and Esau, and this conflict and the lies and the tricks that we're going to see in this Torah portion are going to boomerang and come back later again. Basically, in my mind, we are starting the road to Egypt in this week's Torah portion, because we're starting the road of family dynamics, which are tough and trickery, and there's like beginning here is a little bit of a lack of sweetness.
It's true, there's a lack of sweetness, and it is not only going to boomerang down to Egypt, but I think will continue to spiral through time to our very day. I mean, because there's an internal model here in the struggle between Jacob and Esau, these two brothers, these twins, that is going to play itself out, as we can, I think, and will identify in our time. But I would say, I find some excitement there as well. Because if you can identify the roots of a problem, then you have taken a significant step closer to solving it. And the very fact that we're sitting here in the middle of Jerusalem today, watching it being built with all the messiness and confusion around that, tells me that the time has come actually to get to the source of the problem and solve it.
Okay, well, we're going to definitely be using on today's Torah portion, we're specifically going to be using your historical strengths, I think, because this is very much a Torah portion that leads us to a historical conflict that has played on. And that conflict between Esau, and Jacob, is not just a conflict of hate. It's also a conflict of love. Meaning to say that the Jewish people have many times been attracted to and have yearned for and have written many books about Jerusalem and Rome or this is the new Jerusalem and this is the new Jerusalem, and always has to do with somehow mixing certain Jewish values with Western values. And when we're talking about Esau, we're talking about Westernism, Western values. That's the way our rabbis have actually identified kind of Esau with Edom, Rome. And it's a kind of, in the Jewish mind, when we talk about Esau, we're talking about Western Gentiles, the Western world, and that very, how should we call it, dynamic.
Cultural, a cultural continuum.
Yeah.
Now, here's a question for you, because you gave correctly the classic rabbinic view from Esau, the brother of Jacob, to Edom, that nation, and then from Edom to Rome, and then Rome ultimately to sort of Greco-Roman Christian culture. Here's a question for you, though. There's a missing link in that progression. Can you identify it? We know how you get from Esau to Edom. The Torah itself tells us that Esau is Edom. It actually goes out of its way twice to emphasize.
Edom is supposed to be to our east here.
South, southeast.
Right.
The Nabataean culture, south, southeast. Yeah, I mean, right. the what we consider the modern-day Negev in southern Jordan.
Right.
The capital is at Petra sometimes.
Across from the Red Sea. Across from the Dead Sea.
Yeah, but also to the south of us, south of Judea.
Right, Idumeans.
Exactly.
That's here. Herod is an Idumean.
So, and we know how we get from Esav to Edom. And we know how we get from Rome to general Greco-Roman Christian culture. That's clear when Christianity takes over the Roman Empire. How do you get from Edom to Rome?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
I don't know.
There's no clear line. If you look for some sort of cultural continuity.
Herod is an example.
He's not just the example. In my opinion, Herod is the link.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I'll make a quick plug that if those of you are listening to the Land of Israel Network, my Jewish Story History podcast is coming out. And in a few weeks, you'll hear the edition on Herod. So you can keep this in mind and listen in when it comes out. But for now...
So that's at thelandofisrael.com.
Yep. It's called The Jewish Story.
The Jewish Story with Rabbi Mike Foyer. We're going to be talking about Herod. And just I'll raise. What did they say in poker? Like I'll see your plug and raise you one, which is the latest film that I just made about Hebron, the secrets of the tomb of the patriarchs in Hebron. Also has a large section about Herod, who is the builder.
Who is the builder of the structure there?
And that's at the YouTube page of the Land of Israel Network as well.
Excellent. So why am I mentioning Herod? Because Herod has two faces. He has two faces. Throughout history, what's Herod's nickname? He's Herod the...
Great.
Or Herod the...
Terrible?
Yeah, wicked. It depends on how you write. Meaning, he's got these two faces. He's Herod the Great because of the amazing structure he built in Hebron, because of the Second Temple, which he rebuilt and glorified, because of the strength of the state which he built and his amazing ability to navigate the complex waters of the transition from the Roman Republic to the Roman Empire. He's called Herod the Wicked because he did a lot of really bad things. He killed the sages. He oppressed people. He built idolatrous temples, et cetera, et cetera. He's got these two faces because on one hand, Herod was a Jew. He was a Jew. He was the son of an Idumean forced convert, but he saw himself as a Jew, and much of Judea accepted him as such. He glorified the temple, after all. On the other hand, Herod was more Roman than the Romans. Have you seen the Colosseum at Caesarea? Yeah? Many people see that, and they immediately think of what?
The Colosseum.
The Colosseum at Rome.
Right.
Right. But many people are unaware that the Colosseum at Rome was built almost 100 years after
mm-hmm.
what Herod built.
Mm-hmm.
Herod wasn't imitating. He was actually giving an example upon which that Colosseum would be at least referentially built. Mm-hmm. Right? Because Herod has the two faces of Am Yisrael. On one hand, he is a Jew. On the other hand, he's more Roman than the Romans.
Right.
And so therefore, the rabbis, when they wanted to get from Edom to Rome, all they had to do was place Herod right in between. Because those two faces, on one hand, he's looking toward his original origins from Edom. On the other hand, he's looking toward Rome. And right in between is our story of Toldot, mm-hmm. of these two brothers, Yaakov and Esav. Right? Because if we look, how's the story start? With hard pregnancy. Well, it first starts with barren Rivka.
20 years of barrenness.
20 years of best.
All right, so let's break it down.
Yeah, we'll come back to where the connection is.
We'll come back to that connection. Absolutely. We're going to come back to the connection, and our trigger is going to be between Caesarea and Jerusalem. Okay,
yes.
We'll get to that in a second. So we're at the Torah portion of Toldot, which is Book of Genesis, chapter 25, verse 19 is where we begin it. And basically, what did we learn? We learned that we had this, last week's Torah portion, this romantic journey, and then bringing Rivka into the tent of Sarah, and he loved her, and it's just this beautiful, beautiful, almost non-conflict ridden Torah portion, right?
It's very sweet.
It's just very sweet. It's like there's a sweetness to it, and we were in Hebron last week, and there was 25,000 people, just very, very sweet to celebrate, the purchase of Maariv HaMachpelah and the continuum from Yitzchak. This week's Torah portion, it's like, here is the life of Yitzchak. He married Rivka. Then they didn't have any kids. Then they prayed for what turns out to be 20 years. And then it was a hard pregnancy. And again, if you remember last week's Torah portion, I told you that Rivka, Rebecca, is a very tachlis, hands-on, brass tacks person. And she's like, something's going on here. I will now ask the Lord. And the Lord is like, okay, here's the info. I want you to know what's going on in your pregnancy. What's going on in your pregnancy is that two nations are in your womb. Two regimes from your insides shall be separated. The might shall pass from one regime to the other, and the elder shall serve the younger. Bum, bum, bum.
Yeah, that last line is going to echo down for the next 3,000 years.
Right. And so this Torah portion begins very much with, it's a little bit of a kind of weird trick. It says to you, hey, this is about Isaac's life, but really it's all about Jacob and Esau. That's what it's really all about. And what Isaac is going to be doing is really going to be the link between Abraham and Jacob, and he's going to try to hold those two pieces together, and he's going to form the character of Jacob, because the Torah is going to tell us the character of Jacob, as opposed to Esau, who's a man of the field. Esau is a man of the field. Jacob is a man who dwells in tents. He dwells in tents. He's a tent dwelling. And his mother,
a homebody.
Huh?
He's a homebody.
In my mind, he's a mama's boy at the beginning.
Yeah,
right? He's a little bit of a mama's boy in the beginning. And Isaac loved Esav because he's a man of the field. He gets her done. He gets it done out there. He brings home the bacon. Okay? He is a man of action and get it done. He's born all ruddy and hairy and formed. That's what we talked about last year. Yaakov, also in your language, is emerging. He's an emerging character. Right now, he's still kind of young. He's still kind of gentle, and he's a tent dwelling, and his mom loves, is supposed to love, the Torah says, she loves him in the present tense. That's what we meet, and then immediately the Torah is going to jump into the tensions between these two brothers. And Rivka got this prophecy saying, listen, there's going to be a tension between these two giant regimes that are going to emerge forth from your womb. And the fight begins at birth when Jacob is holding on to the heel of Esau, and immediately afterwards, the kind of first thing that we meet about them is the first time we meet these two characters as their own people, other than the baby moment, is Esau is coming back from the field. He's coming back from the field, and he's tired. Actually, it says first that Jacob started pouring a soup. He's making a soup, a red soup. He's stirring the porridge, stirring the pot, and it smells. It smells good. It smells good. Interestingly, it's a vegetarian type food, and exactly that's the verse says that first Yaakov starts making the soup, and the next thing is that Esau is coming from the field and he is tired. He's tired.
He is worn out, as we spoke about last year, because he is the self-made man. His whole life out there in the field and in trapping and doing and getting it done, like you said, doesn't allow for an identity which can simply be. And, you know, you mentioned before that this is a struggle of love and a struggle of hate, and that these brothers, their struggle begins in the womb. I would give it the overarching struggle of identity, because they're twins. And the question is, who will inherit? Who will tell this story? What is the identity of the Jewish people? As you said, we're going to write books praising both Rome and Jerusalem. We're going to build Caesarea and Jerusalem. So who are we exactly? It comes down, and by the way, it's not just a tension between the brothers you named. It's an existential struggle. They both cannot be at one. One will lead and the other one will follow, or not.
Well, these are big things that you're talking about, and yet it comes down to a bowl of soup.
That's
a little weird.
Well, it doesn't come down to a bowl. It comes down to values. Is that Esau needs what he needs, and he needs it now. He wants to drink the pleasure of life and eat it. This bowl of soup is an extension of what he's doing out there in the field, pursuing that moment and its richness and the amazing engagement with the world that involves, which might give us a hint we can talk about later about why it was that Yitzchak actually loved him, right? But Yaakov is stirring the pot. He's waiting to see what's going to come up. He has a picture he's received sitting there in the tent speaking to his mother about where things are headed. He also is able to seize the moment, but Esau doesn't get that. Esau thinks he's a weak, sort of ineffective character, because he doesn't understand that constant action is no substitute for vision. Right? You can get a lot done if you're willing to engage every moment as it is, but if you don't have a vision of what you're trying to do, then oftentimes what you'll do is misfire, if not downright break something.
Or spin your wheels.
Right. And so what happens when he comes in that moment is all he can see is the soup. And Yaakov starts to speak to him about the birthright, because that's what they're struggling about. Yaakov, you said, was holding Esau's heel on the way out. Who's the older brother?
So Esau is the older brother, ostensibly.
Ostensibly so, and yet the elder will serve the younger. Why was Yaakov holding on to his heel? So Rashi brings in a bizarre midrash. He says actually Yaakov was conceived first, right? And that he is therefore the older brother. But just like if you took two marbles and you put them into a straw, right? The one they put in first, you'd have to take out second. So too, since Yaakov was conceived first and Esav second, Esav had to come out first. And so Yaakov was trying to sort of stop this confusion and hold Esav back so that the world would actually know who was the elder brother. But in doing this, he set the pattern that there is no elder brother of significance in the Tanakh who actually inherits. And this struggle, who is the elder brother or who is the younger brother, right? Meaning, is what's important that I was there first, or what's important I am real to what is now, goes to the core of the struggle between Judaism and Christianity throughout time.
What's interesting also is that Jacob is, one could say, scheming, plotting, but certainly harnessing that energy. He's aware of Esav's weakness.
Oh, absolutely.
And he's entrapping, or harnessing, or really, as the British would say, being clever. He's being very clever here, right?
Yeah, in that context, it's important to know a lot of people are very uncomfortable with his character. You know, first he basically strong arms Esav in a moment of weakness and gets him to sell.
But he never strong arms him.
Okay,
this is an important point.
Exploits his vulnerability in the
right,
moment.
Right, but this vulnerability is ridiculous. Also, there's something ridiculous about it. We're talking about, and I mean this, we're talking about a bowl of soup here.
Yeah,
we're talking about a bowl of vegetable soup.
I'm gonna die if I don't get
right,
it. Though.
But, right, there's a you're being a drama. You're being a what do we say in America? Drama queen. You're like
right.
You're like what's your deal, man? You know how to hunt and kill, and we learn later he knows how to make food. So what's your deal? Where did your energy go? There's something ridiculous in the sale of the Bechora,
Well, very illuminating because Esau's essence in that moment is revealed that he is passionate and powerful, filled with desire for the things of the world as they present themselves now. Right? And Yaakov has the ability to understand that that's a shortcoming. You might engage the world deeply, but you'll consume it before its true fruits can emerge.
Maybe you're also kind of the way you're setting it up. It's Rabbi Mike Foyer. You're setting up a tension also between the contemplative and the action.
Not quite contemplative. I mean, Yaakov has that in him. He is the Ish Yoshev O'alim, right? He sits in the tents and watches things happen. But it's more the difference between poise and recklessness, mm-hmm. because Yaakov doesn't hesitate in this moment.
Right, and we're going to learn more about Yaakov not hesitating. In any case, so he's pouring him the soup, and the Medrash great image says that he like pours the soup down his throat. I love that. In the little Midrash says for kids, you have a picture of this wild man, Esau, and he's just laying back, and Yaakov is like pouring into his mouth. And by the way, interesting enough, he is feeding him.
Yes.
It is real. He is feeding his brother.
Absolutely.
He lives another day, right? He may even live a day to try to kill Yaakov, but he's going. Yaakov energizes him. He did make him a good soup. He didn't poison the soup, right? He made him good soup. He did nourish him. By the way, again, it interests me that it's a non-meat soup. It just interests me. Because Esav is like this meat-eating character. Mm-hmm. You know, and he gives him this like vegetable. You know, there's subtext here. There's a lot of times he gives him a kind of...
I think there's also a reality of the context in which they live.
That's to tame him, I mean to say.
I hear it. But they also have to remember the reality in which they live is the vast majority of their food came from lentils and wheat.
Yeah, but at the end of the Torah portion, we'll see a nice meat dish coming out.
No question.
Out.
They were pastoral. Right? I think it's also important to note that Yaakov, in this sense, is redeeming an overarching human archetype. Right, we've spoken a little bit before about how people like to look at sort of comparative Near Eastern mythologies and say, oh, see, the Torah is nothing unique, right? There was a Gilgamesh flood story and there was it. So Yaakov is the trickster. You know, it is a dominant theme. If you do a little bit of cross-cultural sort of mythological analysis, see that the trickster is a very important character. But here, because Yaakov doesn't stay Yaakov, but ultimately, as we'll speak of in weeks to come, becomes Yisrael, he is consistent with the Torah's theme of dealing with the world as it is, but showing you how to redeem it, how to lift it up, and not be left in that sort of cross-cultural comparative mythology of saying, oh, look, that's what it is, that's what humanity is, and that's what it will always be. So you better know the archetypes so you know how to deal with people. No, no, no. This story introduces us. Yes, we know how it is. You know, Yaakov is able to have that poise in the larger picture that allows him to manipulate his brother here, and we're going to see the true story of manipulation shortly enough. But we know, because we've read this story before, is that he will be challenged and even broken around this, and ultimately what will emerge is Yisrael, a redeemed way of relating to the world.
A word I like to say, if you don't like the word redeemed, which is graduate to another level, reach yes, another level, hit absolutely. Another level. Okay, so now we're in the Torah, chapter 26 of the book of Genesis. We're talking about the split between Esav and Yaakov. Suddenly, the Torah is going to come back to what we thought was the original theme, which is Yitzchak, right? We have this forefather, Yitzchak. He's a silent type, seemingly. You know, he had a...
Had a hard childhood.
Had a wild, wild moment there in childhood. Maybe he was 37 years old at that time, according to the Midrash. And I'm talking about the binding, of course. I'm talking about coming up to the Temple Mount with your father, being tied up and almost sacrificed according to the plain text, and as we talked about last week's show, actually being sacrificed on a mystical sense, and being this, the rabbis will liken Yitzchak to a perfect offering, and he's going to be disallowed by God from leaving the land of Israel. You don't need to leave this land. You never need to leave this land. You don't need the experiences, the worldly experiences. You don't need that. I want you to stay here. I want you to be almost, I don't need you to be wise and worldly. Your silence and your simplicity and your rock-like hardness is fine. You don't need to soften it. You don't need to learn about the world. And so God is going to tell him, don't leave the land of Israel. Stay in this land, inherit it for the sake of your father who kept my commandments. That's just one bit that we learn about Yitzchak. And the next bit is that he's going to go down to the Philistines, not in Egypt, in Philistia, basically, and which is around where Gaza is today, the Gaza Strip. And it seems like the old tale, but a little harsher than the old tale, meaning to say he's going to go down and his wife is very beautiful. We already knew that. And they're going to be interested in his wife. He's going to say, she's my sister. Worked for my dad.
We've heard this story before.
Right. And later on, they're going to see that she's not his sister. And this is where this hard Yitzchak that we meet, it says about him that he's laughing with his wife, having some kind of relationships with her. And again, you kind of remember the softer love relationship that we talked about, that Yitzchak loves Rivka. He's mitzachek with her. He's playing with her. He's laughing with her. So there's a sweetness in that word. In any case, Avimelech, the king of the Philistines, says basically, hey, you know, we almost took your wife. How could you have done that?
Yitzchak says it like it is.
Yeah, he's like,
I thought you'd just kill me and take her.
Right. He's very, very blunt. There's a super bluntness about him.
Yep.
At the same time, at every turn, Yitzchak is being blessed. This time, he finds 100 Ma'asharim. You know that neighborhood in Jerusalem, Ma'asharim? It comes from the Bible.
It's often mistakenly translated as 100 gates.
Right. It's 100-fold.
Yes.
100-fold. That's what it is. Ma'asharim. Shar, by the way, means in modern Hebrew today and in the Daf Yomi right now, it means the exchange rate.
Yep.
The market price. That's what it really means. Market price. That's what it means. So it's all relationship to economics. And there's one of the most beautiful verses in the Torah. Vayigdal ha'ish, vayelech haloch v'gadel, ad ki gadal me'od. And the man grew, and he kept going and growing until he grew very much. And the Philistines are going to be jealous about him. He's going to leave the Philistines. The Philistines, like last week when the Israeli Arabs and Palestinians were burning the forests of Israel, here it says that the Philistines would fill up, what do you call it, stop up the wells, like total destructive what's the word I always like to use about this? Instead of creative energy, it's
destructive?
Entropic.
Entropic energy.
And I'm just going to finish up right here. They're going to dig different wells. Finally, they're going to get to this last well. It's going to be called Rechovot, wideness. spaciousness, yeah. Spacitude, and that is going to be the rabbis are going to take that as a sign that there will be a third temple built one day.
Yes.
There'll be a first temple destroyed. That was the first well. The second well, the second temple. Third well is wideness, spaciousness.
Spaciousness and also an absence of conflict.
Right. The absence of conflict.
Yeah, because, listen, a lot of this parsha is about how to reconcile relationships.
Right.
Right? Because on one hand, Yitzchak moves in with the Philistines. And when things are tough, it's quite fine for him to take shelter in their land. He, because he's so successful, they start to feel crowded. And he says, fine, I'll move on. But there's been a seed of jealousy planted.
There's been
a seed of jealousy planted. They basically follow him. First, like you said, stopping up the wells and saying, no, move on. And then when he finally gets to a wide open space, they eventually, what do they come to him and say? Oh, wait, you have to make a covenant with us because we see that God has blessed you.
Right. They hate him. And then when he leaves, chase him.
I think it's important to distinguish between hatred and jealousy.
Okay, they're jealous of him.
You hated me. I understand. That's the way he experiences it. But right. Why do I mention it? It's because jealousy has a tikkun. There is a way to fix it. Because jealousy is based on this idea of scarcity, of insufficiency. That if you're doing well, then I must have lost something in the exchange. And that's so much of the world that we live in. We see the roots of it here. And by the way, we also see it in the struggle between Yaakov and Esau. There's only one blessing from my father. There's only one birthright, right? It's either you or me, right? And that, and there's a truth to that. And to deny it, I think, is to ignore the truth of history. At the same time, when we speak about redemption, the core of redemption is a consciousness of abundance, right? And the sense of rechovot, like, no, listen, akoyacho, God is capable of doing everything. You got to work with me on this. You know, you don't look at me and be jealous. Don't look at me and have what we call tzarat ayin, that you see in my success your diminishment, right? And one of the challenges that Yaakov will have as the father of the Jewish people will be how to actually rejoice in his glory and his riches without projecting the diminishment of others. In the same way, the world has to learn how to see him as a glorious figure without feeling themselves diminished. And it really starts with his father. And this whole strange back and forth, there's a tremendous amount of lines about the land struggles here. Last thing, and then I'll stop, it's not that God told him it's not worth it for you to leave the land. He doesn't belong out there. The status of Yitzchak as Ola Tamima, as a true perfect offering, is rooted in the land because there's a wholeness of being, from the physical to the emotional to the intellectual to the spiritual, which Yitzchak represents, that if you take it out of the land, it so to speak, doesn't exist. So God says, listen, you're the one that needs to hold this wholeness of being. Your ashes are in front of me on the altar, and you're walking on earth at the same time. And in many ways, I think it opens up the door for why it was that he saw in Esau what he himself was lacking.
So, right, that's right. He likes Esau. One of the mysteries of why Isaac likes Esau, why Yitzchak likes Esau, is because he sees in him this kind of man of action, this man, worldly man. My wife gave me a great idea about that, and she says, who is his older brother, Yitzchak's? It's Ishmael. He grew up with him for a while, and he kind of looks up to him a little bit, this tough guy, this guy. And
not
he sees
that.
In Esau a kind of Ishmael.
Absolutely. But not only that, he also sees Abraham. Listen, Abraham got it done. He fought battles.
Got it done.
He went and conquered countries. He traveled. He made converts. Yitzchak has been so drawn into himself through that experience of the ultimate divine sacrifice, that I think that he also might see a bit of Abraham in Esau as well.
Right.
I realize that in order to move forward, he's not capable of moving forward.
Right.
He, as you said, is the link. Right?
Right. But so and everything I was saying, we're basically putting up this idea that Esau is the get-it-done man, the CEO, the action man. And Jacob, so far, all we've seen of him is that he grabs hold of the foot, in a sense saying, hey, I belong first.
Because that's part of his vision.
Right.
He actually knows what's supposed to happen.
Right. Well, we don't know what his vision is, but you understand that afterwards. We meet this guy who's making a soup at the right place at the right time. Being at the right place at the right time, by the way, there's a wisdom to it.
There's a wisdom, and again, I would say it's beyond wisdom. If you can see how the pieces fit together,
right,
then even in a sort of, like, not even a conscious fashion, but in something which is higher than conscious intellect, you move toward the nexus. You move toward that moment where your actions truly matter.
I don't know why I want to talk about this for just a second, but, you know, this world is one of the big reasons for wars and struggles in the modern era in the last century and a half has been the struggle for energy, for oil.
Mm-hmm.
And who has oil and who doesn't have oil, and basically who has fire burning chemicals in the ground, that petrochemicals that you could use to combust and move and win armies and move your society and make money. And I'm always amazed at the fact that we actually have a nuclear fireball just a few million miles away, and it is raining down
massive amounts of
nuclear heat and energy all the time. And it's like we don't know how to harness it yet. The world doesn't know how to harness this free, clean energy that is just beaming on our face. You could just sit on the beach for half an hour, your face will be tanned. You know, your car, what do you call it? The steering wheel is going to be hot, very hot. Okay, there's a tremendous amount of energy. We don't know how to use it yet. And this is what I'm talking about with Jacob. He sees Esau coming out of the field. He knows that there's a thing here. He knows that there's a thing to harness exactly at the right time.
So I'm working on a project
there's
right
like
now.
There's like science in here. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah,
there's science
I'm
in here.
I'm working on a project right now with someone on sources of Jewish textual sources on solar energy. And he showed me a video of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Alav Shalom, in 1981, speaking about the importance of solar energy. Incredible, because what he says, that anybody who ignores solar energy is mazniach bracha. Right? You're basically abandoning a bracha. That this is a huge bracha that God, it's staring you in the face, like you said, and we don't even see it. And I think that is so much of the power that you're identifying in Yaakov, is he sees the bracha that's staring him in the face, and he can't figure out why no one else sees it.
And I wanted to say earlier that the word bracha has a particular meaning, and that is bracha also means, we understand it as blessing, but Rashi says that the word bracha means more.
Yes.
Getting more of something.
That's its core meaning, actually.
Right.
Because blessing doesn't have any meaning. What's
it doesn't
blessing
have blessing.
Mean?
I don't know what that means. I bless right. you. It means more good stuff.
And in its essence, by the way, if you look at the first two words of bracha, bet resh, right, it means, bar means son. Right, and in Aramaic, it means to step out, right? Bracha is that incredible capacity of the infinite creator and the all-encompassing creator to actually enhance creation by creating other, right? You and I, who can live as other, even though we have a belief that we are one, we live as other, and that's the greatest bracha, because that's what allows for newness, it allows for relationship, it allows for growth, right? And that's absolutely why bracha means more. Tosefet.
And I was at a funeral last night, and it was a great funeral. You know, when you go to a community funeral and you see a whole community come around,
it's a powerful thing.
It's a powerful thing. And they read a WhatsApp from the nice lady, Tippi Fern Dobular from Beit El, passed away, God rest her soul, and Shama should have an Aliyah.
Amen.
They read a WhatsApp from her, and it was all about gratitude. And she was just like, and she was writing to her daughter, you know, how much gratitude we should have in life. That's also part of blessing. It's a door to blessing is gratitude.
For sure.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show, Spiritual Cafe. Rabbi Mike Foyer joins us here at Pardes. And it is about to rain here in Israel. We've had since we spoke, I think, there was a whole fire thing that happened here.
It has been since we spoke.
500 fires were hit this country. Many of them, not all, but many of them were of arson nature, terrorist arson. Tremendous destruction. For example, the guy that prays next to me in shul this morning told me that he had been in the army for 3 days. He came back home. He said to his wife, "Let's go rest a little bit. Let's go to your brothers in Neve Tzuf."
Oh,
and they were out there, and then Friday night, they had to get into pajamas, turn on their cars, and leave town because a fire basically destroyed 18 houses and hurt many other houses in that area.
One of the terrible stories that people should think about if they want to try to support those who've been hurt by these fires is Yoram Ra'anan. You know who he is?
Sure.
The artist out in Beit Meir. 40 years of work lost when his studio was destroyed.
That's wild. That is.
And Beit Meir was devastated.
Right. Some of these towns were really, really very, very badly hurt. And that reminds me of the verse in this week's Torah portion that they stopped up the wells, this kind of destructive energy instead of a creative and procreative.
Because when you
energy.
Destroy the land on which you stand, you hurt everyone. There's right. there's nothing positive or life-giving about that.
Right. You're listening to the Land of Israel Network, and I want you to write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. I got an email from Steve who says, Shalom, Yishai, enjoy your talk from last week on Hebron. Your wife is a hoot, and from Texas, too. It was eye-opening to hear you and Rabbi Mike talk Torah. One of my favorite parts of the last talk was about Rivka falling off the camel. We miss that reading in English. Sometimes when you read in English in translation, not sometimes, every time, you really miss a lot of the many dimensions that... what's his name from Back to the Future? Michael J. Fox. He plays the character. I forgot.
I'm not holding.
So he says, you got to think fourth dimensionally, you know, and it's always hard to think fourth dimensionally when you don't understand the language. Here in our Torah portion, I remember one time I met some Gentiles and they were reading the Bible and I said, they were reading about Edom. They said he came out Harry, and that's why his name was and he ate from the red soup, and that's why his name was Edom. It doesn't make any sense.
Nope.
Because Edom means red. Edom means red. That's his color. That's his color of Esav is red. All right. So now let's get to the main event.
The heart of the matter.
Let's get to the heart of the matter. All this portion has been a setup for this through this part of the story, and that is. Isaac is getting old. It's been one parsha. It's just been one little parsha, and Isaac's getting old, and he's going blind, and he wants to bless his son. So he calls his son, the elder son, Esau, and he says, come here. He says, here I am, Dad. He says, listen, looks like I don't know when I'm going to die. I want you to put on your war, your hunting equipment. Go out there in the field and hunt me a hunt and make me the yummy foods that I like. Bring them to me. So that my soul could bless you before I die. Rivka, remember Rivka? Remember the loving relationship? Remember all that? Remember she's coming from Aram Naharaim, right? She's coming from Aram Naharaim, not Haran. She's coming from Aram Naharaim, I think, right? I think she's coming from the land between the two rivers. In any case, she's coming from there, and she falls off the camel when she sees Yitzchak. It's like so beautiful and romantic. This
love
time she's like,
sight.
Love at first sight, man. Love before first sight, you know? And now she says to her younger son, Yaakov, she says, listen, I got something to tell you. It's been told to me, I have heard, that your father wants to bless Esau, your brother. Now, we can't have that happen. So why don't you do the following? I want you to bring me some hunt or some food from... I want you to bring me... Go to the flock here. Bring me some choice goats.
Two goats.
And I'm going to make the yummy foods for the delicacies for your father, which he likes. I know. I'm his wife. Bring it to your father. And he'll eat so that therefore he will bless you before he dies. Say what? What is Rivka telling Yaakov to do? Fake dad out and get a blessing that he doesn't not supposed to get? And Yaakov says to her, look.
That doesn't sound like a very good idea.
Moreover, there's like a technical problem. Before we even get to the moral problem, it's like my brother is a hairy man and I am a smoothie.
That's right.
I'm not one of those hairy guys.
I mean, we're going to see this all play out, ultimately going to be expressed in that amazing phrase, Hakol Kol Yaakov, V'Hayadayim Yedei Esav, right? That the voice is the voice of Yaakov, the hands are the hands of Esav. And here you see it, is Yaakov understands is that, listen, I'm the idea guy.
I'm the idea guy.
I got the vision. Right. But listen, I know my brother, he gets it done. And ultimately, by the way, this is a bit of the vision of redemption, is that you know, we as a people, Baruch Hashem, you look out the window, you can mention the crane, we also get it done. But so much of our power is in our inwardness, in our closeness, in our actual small intensity, right? That isn't going to shape the world brick by brick, right? And learning how to deliver that vision to the world as a whole, so that people with the might of their hands can actually reshape the world in God's image. That's our task. That vision of the Kol Yaakov, and that it's his voice and ultimately will be the hands of Esav that build is going to follow us down through the generations.
All right, we're gonna see that in just a second.
But that's what he fears.
He fears being a liar. He fears being this is a crazy situation that his mom is sticking him into. And again, this is the Rivka that I love so much. She's this Rivka of like no indecision.
Well, not only that, but she's the one who heard from God.
She's an architect.
But don't forget, at the beginning of the parsha, she heard from God. Listen, the elder is going to serve the younger.
This is a little bit like Joseph. Do you see that? It's a little Josephy in that she has a vision for an architecture for time,
mm-hmm.
and she's going to follow through on it, even if it means crazy hoops that don't make sense.
Yes.
She's going to play it through without any doubt, kind of.
Because once again, and I think of also the discussion we had about Eliezer Eved Avraham, like holding on to the Brit Milah. It's like, don't be deceived by the events that are in front of you. Stick with the picture. I've got the big picture. From before these kids were born, I knew who was in charge. I've been raising you, Yaakov, to have that vision, and I see you have that vision. And now's the time, because vision is meaningless if it stays in the tents.
Okay, so meaning to say, it's time for you to
make your move.
You got to make a move. You got to make a move here. And what I want you to do, she takes out these special clothes of Esav, and there's a lot of midrashim about these special clothes. Are these the clothes of Nimrod? These are the original clothes that kind of change shape. They change they visually look like other animals and other things. But it's got these special clothes, these very, very special clothes. And she puts on his, but the simple meaning, she puts on skins of goats on his hands and on the scruff of his neck. And she sends him in with the food. So it's like mom's taking care of everything here. She's dressing you up. She's giving you the food. But you got to go get that blessing.
You got to play
the part. You remember what you did with Esau, that you were in the beginning with Esau, when you were the right person, the right time, with the right food, you just knew how to attract them with that red soup. You got to do the same thing now, and it's with food again. This is a big food parsha. This is the food. This is the food parsha. Okay.
We will be having lentil soup for dinner.
Right. And he goes in there, and Yitzchak immediately there's this crazy tension here. Because you're like, oh my God, this is crazy. And you have this blind father with the power to bless. And the first thing that Yitzchak says to his son, he says, how come you got here so fast? And Yaakov makes a type of mistake, quote unquote. He says, because your God helped me, showed up for me, showed up from before you. He was there for me. He helped me get this thing. So immediately that sends a little bit of some suspicion. It says, why don't you come over here and let me feel you, because you may be Esav or not. Okay? and he comes and he touches him, and he touches his arms and the back of his neck. Do you understand what Esau must have been like if goat's hair...
Goat hair fooled him.
Fooled him, fooled Isaac. And he says this famous phrase, as you said, Hakol Kol Yaakov, Vayadaim Yedei Esav. The voice is the voice of Jacob. Not just the voice, but the words, the way of talking, the things that you're talking about is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esau. Now, my take is a little bit different than your take.
Yeah.
I think this is the Ikar of the blessing. I think this is the real blessing. He says, now you're where you needed to be. Yes, you've got the vision. You got the heart of, you got the voice of Jacob. But you needed those hands of Esau to get it done in this world. And now that I see that you're being tricky on this level, that you're willing to do stuff, you're willing to put on the garb of Esau in this lower domain, now I could bless you. Now I like what I see.
So now let's go back to Herod. Because this is exactly where the rabbis get it. See, he had the hands of Esau. He was building, he built the Colosseum before the Colosseum was built. Right? That amazing structure that you get to spend so much time with there in Hebron, right, will become an archetype of architecture. And yet he lacked the voice of Yaakov. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He fought the sages, right? He didn't want to struggle to fulfill Jewish destiny, and so therefore he passed.
You got to have the voice of Jacob first.
It has to be who you are. So right. I said, this is about the identity.
Right. The other part is the clothing. It's an external clothing.
Exactly.
You got to be clothed in the clothes of Esau.
And I agree with you that in many ways, this is the struggle of our generation now, is that the Zionists who reawakened our physical manifestation as a people and brought us back to this land were very good at the day Esau. I mean, listen, we have pound for pound, arguably the most powerful army in the world.
Jane says that it's the eighth most powerful army in the world.
Okay, fine.
But that's because of our size.
Argue. That's why I said pound for pound.
Right, pound for pound. That's right.
I said pound for pound.
That's right.
Right. We don't have the economic infrastructure to have aircraft carriers and but unfortunately, at the core of much of the secular Zionist vision was actually trying to quiet the voice of Yaakov. And this is why we find ourselves in such confusion today. It's like we have this massive, powerful machine, and we don't know what to do with it. And so we sit on our hands.
It reminds me of the genie in Aladdin.
Mm-hmm.
Giant, world-shaping powers. It's a bit of a living space. That's
yeah,
right.
Exactly.
So the Torah is going to say that Yitzchak is not going to recognize him, and he's going to ask him point blank. He says, "Are you my son Esau?" And he says, "It's me." Now that was ostensibly a lie, but later on, what we're going to learn also. Oh, and then he not only did Yitzchak need to touch him and feel him, when he brought him close, he smelt him. He smelt him. Now this, the sheep's clothes are not going to be the only thing. A scent came in with Yitzchak. This is the scent of the field, the scent of Avraham who bought the field, the scent of the field that Esau that Yitzchak prayed in. There's the smell of the field. The smell is really
of Gan Eden.
The smell of Gan Eden. That's what finishes this off. Mm-hmm. That's when Yitzchak's like, okay, I could bless you. When he smelt the smell of the field, which blessed him. The Tetragrammaton, God's name. God blessed him with this field.
And because if you think about it, don't forget we started this parsha here, not the whole parsha, but the local one we're speaking about now, with the idea that Yitzchak is blind, right? And between his blindness and the smell, which basically causes him to make the right decision. Because don't forget, with all the trickery and the difficulty, and I think it's a mistake to try to read this story in apologetic fashion. There's trickery and difficulty going on here. See it. Embrace it,
right,
and know how it plays out,
right.
But it's critical because what was it that attracted Eve to the tree?
It looked good.
It looked good,
right? It looked good.
It looked good, and then she touched it,
right?
And she tasted it. Right. You know what she didn't do?
She didn't smell
the fruit, right? That's why our sages teach us that smell is the only sense which remains preserved from its Edenic ideal. And here, what is it that causes? It's like he's been blinded. And maybe yes, maybe no, we'll talk about where that blindness comes from. But he's been blinded. He's fooled by his sense of touch. He's hearing, okay, it's kind of tipping it off, but it's not enough. When he smells, he says, I don't know what, I mean, I heard the voice of Yaakov. I felt Esau. I'm so confused. No, that's the smell. This is where to go. And this is, in many ways, is a return to that moment of Eden and an ability to get the world back on track.
And the blessing is very, very tight. Okay, the blessing is very tight, but it's going to be also big. See, the fragrance of my son is like the fragrance of the field which Hashem had blessed. And then he says, and may God give you of the dew of the heavens and of the fatness of the earth and abundant grain and wine. People will serve you, and regimes will prostrate themselves to you. Be Lord to your kinsmen, and your mother's sons will prostrate themselves to you. Cursed be they who curse you, and blessed be they who bless you. That's it.
It's so critical that it is a purely physical blessing. And this is what the proof is that ultimately Yaakov was the right one to receive it. Because that's what Yaakov needs.
Right.
He doesn't need the spiritual blessing.
Right.
He has the coal.
Right.
He has the vision from the womb. What he needs is the ability to embody it in the world.
Okay. So he gets the blessing, very dramatic moment, and we're like, we're done with the story, right? The end.
He's out of there.
Right? You think everything's okay.
I'll come back to the plate later.
Right, but wait a minute. We're not done quite yet. There's another guy. Remember, we just got concentrated on Yaakov and how he got in fast and snuck in beforehand, was the right man at the right time, harnessed the energy. It's great. But there's an Esau out there, and that Esau is coming in with the hunt. And he comes in. and he says, "All right, Dad, get up. I made food for you." He's being a little bit harsh. And suddenly he says to him, "Who are you?" He says, "I am," here's the key words, "I am your firstborn Esau." Wait a minute. There's a lie there too. You're not the firstborn anymore. You sold that away.
Because it's not about technical biological. It's about the value of the relationship, and that he sold.
You sold it. And when you say that, when you made that claim, it's not really true. And that's an important point. People miss that when you read it, maybe in English, you may miss that. In any case, so Yitzchak has a very big fear. Isaac trembled with very great perplexity. And he said, "Who was that other guy who came in here? He's also blessed." He figures it out. And he says, "May he be blessed." But when Esau hears, this is one of the most scary verses in the whole Torah, is it says, "Vayitzak tzaka gdola umara ad meod." He yelled a horribly loud and bitter, very bitter cry. Like a primordial yell. Yes.
And this is a cry which Yaakov will pay for.
Right. You could hear that cry yet today.
Oh, absolutely.
It keeps reverberating.
It absolutely keeps reverberating. And in the place where we don't actually act as the elder brother, where we don't own our birthright and use the power of our voice to try to bring the world toward that divine vision, where we're still afraid and trying to pull a fast one on the forces around us because we see them as more powerful, those are the places we pay for it.
And that's exactly what you're saying, Rabbi Mike, is exactly going to be the blessing that Esau is going to get. Esau is not going to get a blessing easily. He's going to have to beg his father. His father's like, "Sorry.
You missed it.
I'm out of blessings." And that's also a question. What does that even mean? Blessings, what is there? Is there a cup? What you were talking about before, resources.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you said in the beginning. It's like what is there? Just a system. What is the deal? What? There's only one amount of, you know, blessings in this world. Is there a limitation? And Yitzchak seems to signal, I did it. I said it. It's gone. It's spent.
Well, listen, there's two faces to the blessing. One is there is a particular blessing which is being handed down, which God gave to Abraham, which then God then gave Abraham the ability to hand it on, right? The blessing of the land, the blessing of the promise of redemption. That there is only one. There's another power of blessing, and it's the power to see in someone that which is already there that they don't see themselves, and to bring it out and essentially give it to them. And that's the second one that ultimately Yitzchak is able to reach a little bit deeper and give to Esau. So let's see, what does he give him?
Okay, so he's going to say to him, and you have to feel a little sorry for Esau here.
More than a little.
Yeah, you're just like, well, it depends on your character traits. You know, me, I'm a little harsher. I'm like, okay, you know, sorry, buddy. You've been bad. You do bad things. You don't deserve the blessings. And it's actually only a blessing that you were able to lose out, because had you been able to get it, had Hitler been able to win, you would dominate this world in an evil way. I don't feel sorry for you. And I know you want me to feel sorry for you, but the text does make you feel a little sorry for him. I have to admit. He says to him, "Do you only have one blessing, my father? Bless me too, my father." And he raised his voice and cried. The Torah wants you to be like, come on, Yisha, even you can feel bad for Esau, can't you? And Yitzchak says, okay, I got something for you. From the fat of the earth will be, I'll read it right from the translation, "Behold, of the fatness of the earth shall be your dwelling, and the dew of the heavens from above. By your sword you shall live, but your brother you shall serve. Yet when it be that when you are aggrieved, you may cast off his yoke from upon your neck." What does that mean?
That by definition, Yaakov is in charge now. He has the vision, and that, you know, a sword is a amoral tool. It can do anything. It can kill and it can defend, right? It can chop down trees, or it can open up the ground in order to plant, right? But when Yaakov fails to lead you, when you're aggrieved, then okay, you'll be in charge, right? When the world lacks vision, the sword and the lower animal side of the human being will take charge.
And indeed, that is what we have seen. But Esau is not content with that. He harbored hatred towards Yaakov because of the blessing which his father had blessed him, And Esau said to himself, may the days of mourning of my father draw near, then I will kill my brother Yaakov. That's it. You've just heard the inner dialogue of a potential murderer. He says, I want to wipe out Jacob. I want to wipe out this people. I want to kill him. And I want to inherit his inheritance. I want to kill him.
Yeah. I will not serve.
Right.
I will only be master.
Right.
Therefore, I must destroy him.
Right. And this is what the rabbis say, that there's a known halacha. It is an accepted halacha. Not a thought, not a belief, not a measure. It is a halacha that you should know, that Esau hates Jacob.
Yeah, although we're going to see that root of that expression of that halacha at their reunion, at the unique moment when they actually do resolve, for one brief moment, their hatred.
Right. We are going, and there is, that's a very important point that you're making, and that is there is a resolve. There was a resolve for a moment there between Ishmael and Isaac at the burial of Abraham. There's going to be a resolve, but it's in the future. It's messianic. Resolve between the tension between Esau and Jacob is a messianic moment. By the way, isn't it weird that Christianity has adopted a Jewish character as their God? Is that a mixture here also of like Jacob and Esau-ness? It's like the world of Esau takes upon themselves a Jewish God.
As far as I know, early Christianity did not place the emphasis on the Judaism of Jesus.
Right.
I think that's a more modern phenomenon.
Uh-huh.
But I'm not really qualified to analyze it. But what I would say is, it again goes back to the core question that Esau and Yaakov are twins. That the struggle here is a struggle of identity. It's no, don't mistake it for a power struggle. Who's going to be in charge? Who's right? This is a core, just like Herod had those two faces, right? There's a inner struggle for identity, for how to embody the blessing of God in the world. And ultimately, the resolution that's going to happen is to decide, what is that Kol Yaakov? What is that voice that's
right.
speaking?
And we also go back to the verse in Noah, which is Yishkon Yafet Boalei Shem. Like Japheth, which is also the Greco-Roman world, is going to dwell within the tents of Shem, as the greater godly idea is going to control the world. All that ability to do and create will be within that framework, and you do see that today. And I want to say right now that I don't want anybody to get their feelings hurt, because I really do believe that many listeners to the show who are Gentiles, who are in a sense coming from the Esavian world, are part of that redemption, that effort to come into the tents of Jacob. I have many friends, my good friends at High Yovel, who are coming Christians, or are coming here to prune, till, and work the land of Samaria and the land of Israel in order to bring out beautiful kosher grapes that make beautiful kosher wine. I really do believe that this is Japheth coming into the tents of Shem, and this reconciliation that we talk about, that we'll talk about in a few weeks' time. There is a reconciliation, and people like myself believe that we are living in that time. We are living in a at least broaching that time.
And I think that a very important element about our ability as Jews to accept that love and to join into that partnership is the fact that here we are once again rooted in our land. That we are not sort of ephemeral voice echoing in the corners of another culture, but that actually once again embodying ourselves and being able to stand with dignity and embrace the world in the fullness is a critical element of that redemptive ability then to join with the nations of the world into building that divine vision.
If we don't have the tents of Shem, you can't come into it.
That's
true. The land is the key. You have to have that, and you have to have that self-confidence.
Mm-hmm.
I say what you just said a little bit in the same thing, but in just a different way, which is that when we're living on their lands, they say, hey, Jew, you listen to our story. Listen to Madison. Listen to Washington. Listen to the Aristotle. Listen to our great thinkers and spiritual lights. But when we're back on our land, so then the Gentiles are asking us, well, what is your Torah about? Tell us. Now that God has redeemed you and brought you back, and obviously there's a great light shining forth from Jerusalem, like you, now it's time for you to tell us. In the meantime, you've had to listen to us, but now that you're on your land, we're all ears.
And the challenge of our day is learning to speak to them, because we've been speaking to ourselves in whispered voices in the corners for so long,
right,
is that we have, to a little certain degree, forgotten how to really project. And it's our task for today.
Well, we're going to talk more about that when we talk about the transition between Jacob and Israel, okay? But be all that as it may, we're not there yet in the Torah. In the Torah, you got to run, boy. You got to run, squirrel, because you are in trouble. And that is Rebecca comes to Yaakov. Now, I don't know if I mentioned this beforehand. Yaakov says, Mom, I think I'm going to bring a curse upon myself and not a blessing. She's like,
it'll be fine. The curse is on me.
The curse is on me. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. It's going to be fine, fine, fine. No curse, no shmurs. I'll take the curse.
And then she says, well, listen, it's probably a good idea to run away.
You got
to
hightail it out of here. I'm sorry, boy.
Maybe it was a bad call.
But wait, Mom, but I'm a tent-dwelling mama's boy soup-making person. I'm not ready for no... You got to roll out of here. Your brother Esau, you really just ticked him off bad, okay? So you got to go now out of here. It's just like every nightmare of Jacob's is going to come true. Instead of being blessed, he's going to be cursed in his mind, at least at first. It's like you kicked, like I've lost everything that I know.
Lost his brother, lost his father, lost his home.
Right. And lost his closeness to his mother.
Yeah, absolutely.
So everything is going to go the bad way. Just so you know, though, at the end of the Torah portion, there is, you would have thought that Rebecca and Isaac were never going to talk to one another again. Nothing of the sort. She again comes up to him. She says, listen, I can't stand the local women for Jacob. I'm going to die if he marries them. So Isaac is like, sure, honey, no problem. You know, he says, Jacob, he says, he blessed him again. He said,
I have
to him,
a good idea.
Right. That's right. Right. This is like a big Frat Greek wedding. You know, the man is the head, but the woman is the neck. Right. So he says, right, exactly. He's like, I've got a great idea. You cannot take a wife from the Canaanite women. I want you to go to Paddan Aram. Where is Paddan Aram? Isn't that the Aram Naharaim?
Yeah, it's probably in the sort of Turkish area of the headwaters of the Tigris and Euphrates.
Right. So he says, he gives him a blessing, and he says to him, basically, may Hashem, may he grant you the blessing of Avraham to you and your offspring with you. May you possess the land of your sojourn, which God gave to Abraham. And he sent him on his way. And
now get out of here.
Now get out of here. And again, we also see that Esau marries women that are not to the liking of his parents. So he's going to go. There's a split here, and we just got a kind of picture of the tension between Esau and Yaakov that is not reconciled here in this week's Torah portion. But that's going to be more or less the end of Yitzchak. What is that about? I wanted to ask you at the end, like that's all we know of this great forefather? What does he mean to us? Remember that I asked you this year that we try to get a good grip on who the forefathers and mothers are. Who is Yitzchak here then?
Two things come to my mind. One is, as we said, the power of the link, right? And I guess they're the same, because the other that came to my mind was that image of his ashes there on the altar. And I think it's hard for us to relate to the power of what it is to do something not for oneself, for the development of one's place in history, but simply to make sure there's continuity, right? Yitzchak, he left his selfhood there on the altar. He had his moment of absolute divine service, right? And we see it a little bit expressed in his prayer there in the field afterwards. But now his whole task here, as we see, all this maneuvering in this whole book is to make sure that the blessing gets handed on. And I see that it's a critical element, as I've said so many times, that whatever one may think of various phases of Jewish history and the various embodiments, and like, I deal with a lot of very liberal students who have problems with the rabbis, and you know, like what I often say to them is, listen, whatever you think, if the rabbis hadn't done what they did, we would not be sitting here having this conversation today. So you must respect. You take your time and your autonomy, do what you're going to do, but do not fail to understand that the dedication, the absolute dedication to God, which the sages had, and certainly which Yitzchak literally embodies, is what allows our story to move forward.
Given the way you just said it, it really, the Torah portion becomes all about being able to pass on this energy. You know what? Did you ever see the movie about the penguins and the penguins in the snow? It's like this documentary, Everybody saw it as a it's this crazy documentary about these super like penguins living in like the Arctic, and they're passing this little egg between one another. The mom lays the egg, but then the father like puts it under his own fat, and they have to carry it throughout the whole winter. This egg, it's like you gotta somehow pass it on. You gotta get the blessings. You gotta catch the rays, and you gotta stay safe. And now you gotta get out of here.
That's right.
All right, folks, we got to get out of here as well. So I want to thank you all very much. You are listening to Spiritual Cafe and the Yishai Fleischer Show with Rabbi Mike Foyer and myself, Yishai Fleischer, here at Pardes. I want you to write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Tell me about these Torah portions. How are they moving you? Tell me about the flag of Israel that you've, a bumper sticker that you put on your car or you're flying or something like that. Tell me about the wine of the land of Israel that you're drinking. Tell me about the other shows that you're listening to. Show me a picture of your kids and how you guys are growing and doing. It is a supreme pleasure to be in your ears. I hope that you're listening to this before Shabbos and getting ready for the Torah portion, whoever and wherever you are. And it makes us supremely happy when you send us an email and give us a sense of who you are out there. And how you're connected to the story of the land of Israel. Folks, there's a lot of stuff, a lot of energies that want to block this light from coming forth. So when you let me know that you caught the light from Jerusalem, somewhere out there, wherever you are, it makes us feel that light is shining and it's affecting you wherever you are. So keep that energy strong. Rabbi Mike, I want to thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom, brothers and sisters. Stay tuned, stay strong. And more great stuff is coming up right now. Me and Malka Fleischer. Stay tuned and Shalom.
The best place to stay in Jerusalem is at Windows of Jerusalem Vacation Apartments. Check out their website, www.windowsofjerusalem.com. They've got beautiful 1, 2, 3, 4 bedroom apartments in the best location in the city center with the most beautiful, breathtaking views. And I mean breathtaking. I've stayed there a number of times myself. And I'm telling you, there are few places anywhere in the city where you can take it all in to this degree. The view, the location, the great apartments, plus the wonderful staff, will truly make you feel at home in Jerusalem. Book your stay now at windowsofjerusalem.com.
Folks, we're back here on the Yishai Fleischer Show, and now we're at the Laurianne Schwartz Bernath Studios on the Mount of Olives. That's my home office studio overlooking the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. As I turn my head, there is the Golden Dome, great placeholder for that third temple. And we're in Jerusalem, we're at my house. That means we're also with Malka Fleischer, show hostess with the mostest.
Yay.
Shalom, Malka. How are you?
Thank you, Yishai. It's good to be back. 2 weeks in a row.
Amazing. Yes, thank you. Thank you so much. There was a pause from the audience. Yes, like, wow, just, everybody was around.
There was awe that we needed to let the space for happiness.
Well, the truth is I don't have too much time because we're recording right before I have to run out the door and go give a very special tour to a very special group. That group is actually Israeli college kids from Universitat Bar Ilan, University. And that university is the first in our project with an organization called Im Tirtzu, which is basically like a nationalist, patriotic organization working on Israeli campuses to fight the post-Zionist, anti-Zionist narrative that takes a hold not in the California campus, but actually here in Israel. So we are organizing with them to fight the Shovrim Shtika phenomenon, Shovrim Shtika that's breaking the silence. They're bringing it to Hebron and teaching the un-narrative. They're teaching the un-narrative through Hebron. They're actually showing, you know, the security and all that kind of stuff and spinning it as though Israel is subjugating the Arab minority in its midst. And they really un-narrativize the people of the country through their tours that they give her practically for free. That's what we're doing now to counteract them, is get on the college level. And I heard an interview with the head of Shovrim Shtika,
Breaking the Silence.
He says, they asked him about Im Tirtzu making tours to Hebron.
Oh, wow.
Hebron. So he's like, it's a gimmick.
A gimmick? Why is that a gimmick?
No, but the funny thing is, I'm like, it's a gimmick that you use then.
I don't get how touring a city is a gimmick, but I do want to say that I think it's a great idea. I think it's a great idea for a few reasons. One, because Hebron is really the root of the whole thing. If you ask me, Hebron is the root of the modern state of Israel. Maybe people wouldn't recognize that because nothing really happened in Hebron to create the modern state of Israel per se. But Hebron is sort of the reason that we come back to the land of Israel at all. It's the place where Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and their amazing wives were buried. It's the place where King David started his kingdom, his kingship, really. And it's the reason that the Jewish people cling on to this land. It's the testimony that God gave this land to the Jewish people, that the Jewish historical and cultural narrative comes out of this place. And I think it makes a lot of sense. You know, Ishai, it's not just Im Tirtzu that comes to Hebron. We had the chance to go just last Shabbat for Parshat Chayei Sarah to Hebron. And we got to see the thousands and thousands of all kinds of different people. And, you know, the one thing there's only one problem with Shabbat Chayei Sarah in Hebron, the Shabbat when everyone comes to read the Torah portion where Abraham bought the Machpelah cave in Hebron to bury his wife Sarah. And that problem is, ironically, the Shabbat. Because if we could bring video cameras in to show what's going on there in Hebron, I think it would make a big impact on a lot of people. But it's Shabbat, and on Shabbat, we don't use video cameras. We don't turn on and off electricity, things like that. There's many other rules. You can look it up on Google, on h.com, Chabad.org. But it's just a wonderful, amazing sight. People come with their tents, and I saw people like sleeping. They turned off all the electronic kind of equipment associated with opening the car door, like so the light doesn't turn on in the car. And people were sleeping in their cars, like behind their wheels with sleeping bags and just every possible little nook and cranny. People were sleeping on rooftops, you know, lining the floors of people's living rooms who live there in Hebron. We have the honor of going to Tel Romeda, which is the upper part of Hebron, of Jewish Hebron. And it's close to the tomb of Ruth from the Book of Ruth and Yishai, her grandson, who is the father of King David. And we stay there every year. We stay with the Yahalom family, who make amazing chicken. No coincidence that we stay there. And it was just a really beautiful, it was a beautiful time. They open up the Isaac room. They're basically
The
Isaac Hall, thank you. There are many, many rooms inside the Tomb of the Patriarchs, which is five floors above the actual cave that no one is allowed to go into. And some of these rooms are closed off to Jews most of the year, including the Isaac Hall, the room that's there to commemorate the father Isaac. And so they open it up 11 days, I think, a year. Is that right? 10 days a year for Jews to be in the entire Machpelah. Not coincidentally, they do the same for Arabs. They open it up. There are some days that they open only for Arabs. Or Muslims, rather, is the more correct term.
It's split between the Jews and the Muslims.
Right.
Between
Israelis and Arabs. So there's a certain, and then the other days of the year, it's the Machpelah, the Maat Machpelah is split in half, sort of, and Jews go in their parts and Muslims go in their parts. So anyway, we went into the Isaac Hall, and there's this one kind of hole in the floor, which is protected by like a beautiful grate, like a metal grate. And there is a line on the men's section and the women's section behind this grate and hole in the ground the entire Shabbat, because this is a hole that goes down into the actual cave, and you can take a whiff of the air that comes out of there. They say that is the opening to the Garden of Eden, so you can take a big fat snort of the air of the Garden of Eden there, and I try to make a point of doing that. You say a little prayer. I always whisper a hello to the forefathers down there, and I pray that my children will be like them. Yeah, so it was just a great time. Ate a lot of chicken, saw a lot of people. We brought little seeds for the soldiers to eat. It's a good time to be nice to soldiers.
Sunflower seeds.
Sunflower seeds, right. Sunflower seeds.
I don't think people...
Not like bird seeds.
Right. They're not like, we're not trying to grow chia there on the soldiers.
Right, no. I mean, chia is very healthy, but I'm not sure it's a good snack.
Chia.
So, yeah, we gave out black sunflower seed packets to the soldiers because it's like a good, you know, you're standing there, you're guarding, you can open some seeds. I used to bring Crembo. We talked about this, I think, last week. I used to bring Crembo, my favorite little treat. But I realized all it really does is give you a sugar high and then a sugar crash. And then it just lasts for like 5 seconds anyway. And it has this foil, you know, outside, and hopefully no one throws it on the floor or whatever. So these little seeds, more nutritious. I think it has magnesium.
Yes.
That's my story.
Yes. And everybody loves them. And it's also very social.
Yeah. It's
social
like, oh,
food.
Have some seeds. You have can't share a Crembo.
No, you cannot share a Crembo. All right, folks. You are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show. Today's show is brought to you by the good folks, good friends of ours, Jack and Sarah and Lillian and Moshe out in Brooklyn, who make it all happen for the show. Thank you so much. And God bless you out there. We miss you very much. Our good friends, the Michels, out in Switzerland. Also, the show is sponsored by a good friend of ours, Steve, who is a Rolfer, and that is a treatment that I'm getting right now, which is basically stretching out your spine, fixing your posture, and making you just more in line with gravity altogether. I just had some treatment work or adjustment done in my hips.
Yeah, and you're like, hey, look at my posture.
Yeah, my hips, you know. My hips were connected to my...
Your hips don't lie, Yishai.
Yeah, hips don't lie. That's right. And I just feel much, much more upright. And that's something that you have to be in your land, is komemiyut, is upright.
It's just good. It's good Zionism to get some rolfing.
Yeah, you got to be healthy in your body. That's part of what Zionism is about also. It's a return to the bodily strength together with the spiritual strength. If you want to check that out, that's facebook.com/Israel Rolfing. Rolfing is like golfing, but with an R. Okay, so Israel Rolfing, facebook.com/Israel Rolfing. Also, I want to talk to you, Malka, about the story of last week. It's already gone from the papers, but there were over 500 fires all over Israel.
Unbelievable nightmare.
Now, there was an unusual, maybe historical kind of dry wind, a dryness in the country. Imagine that, like, the whole country was under one of those hand blowers that's just, like, drying out your hands in seconds. That's what it was like. And we all actually felt it on our bodies. Our lips.
Our entire family had chapped lips. It was, but not just chapped lips, like, oh, let me just put on this chapstick, but like the chapstick's not working. Nothing was working. We were walking around for 4 or 5 days with horrible chronic chapped lips that we could not cure.
Right. And we were not the only ones. There were WhatsApp messages going, hey, I've got a special cream.
Yeah. Like everybody. It was like a problem, a nationwide epidemic of chap.
Right. It was chapped lips. And at the same time, the trees out there were dry. It has basically not rained here in Israel yet.
Yeah, it's very winter. Bad. People out there may not appreciate what that means, because you kind of live with rain and people have droughts in different places, but it's mostly because you guys aren't very good at conserving water, no offense. Here in Israel, it doesn't rain for months and months and months at a time. It hasn't rained here since Passover. That's April time.
Right.
Okay. So we've been waiting for rain now for almost 8 months.
Right. And as we're recording this right now, today was supposed to be a rainy day. Right now,
sunshine.
Sunshine.
Right. Sunshiny, and it's a beautiful day. And you go outside and you're like, it's pretty today. And then you're like, that's bad.
That is bad. And it turns out the jihadists use this opportunity to light fires throughout the country. And they're reporting right now that at least a half of the fires that were started by arsonists. That's 250 fires
all
over the country.
That's a lot of fires.
I don't believe that number at all. I think that's a total cover-up. I think it was 90% of those fires were started by arsonists.
There were some. Let's just go the other direction and say there were some actual natural wildfires.
That's
there
right.
were some natural wildfires. But the fires that destroyed property were arson fires.
That's right. They were started close to Jewish communities. And in fact... A good friend of mine was in Shabbat, Neve Tzuf. He's an Orthodox Jew, and he was in Shabbat.
An Orthodox rabbi,
and fires started engulfing the community of Neve Tzuf. They had to evacuate in cars on Shabbat.
In their pajamas. They jumped into cars on Shabbat night, which is, thank God, everyone was okay. And, you know, the last time we had this big Carmel fire, which honestly doesn't even compare to the fires that we had now, there was horrible loss of life. So you really have to commend the fire department, the nationwide fire department, and you have to thank God that nobody was killed, God forbid. And I understand that most injuries were not terribly serious.
Right. Now,
so thank God for that. But there were many people who lost their homes. Apartment buildings went up in flames.
Right.
Homes went up in flames. I know of an art gallery that was destroyed.
Neve Tzuf. Lost 18 homes, just 18 homes.
Right. Can you imagine what that is for a second?
Like,
and let's
homeless.
Just say that you have insurance, okay? And that covers everything. It's like, and what about your grandma's, you know, wedding ring? And what about your baby pictures? And what about your marriage certificate? And what about your wallet? You know what I'm saying? What about your you know, love letters that your husband wrote you? Like, these things are gone. And my heart breaks for them. You know, I can't imagine what it would be like. And Isha, you know, it's sort of like disappearing out of the news. And that's a real shame, because these people are going to need a lot of help. And I hope that in upcoming shows, maybe we will be able to talk a little bit about how we can continue to help these people who will be needing a lot of support.
Very good point, Malka. I want to concentrate one more aspect of this fire, and that was how some of the news media covered it. It turns out that the Palestinian Authority sent a few fire trucks to help put out some of the flames. And immediately the news story shifted to something like this. A tragedy, a natural tragedy, a natural disaster struck Israel, and Jews and Arabs got together to fight the flames. It's a story of coexistence and oneness at a time that tragedy strikes, we all come together. That's what the story was basically. It was on the Times of Israel. It was kind of touted everywhere. I spoke to some people who were fighting fires. They said, look, the Palestinian firefighters, we oftentimes are the ones going into Palestinian Arab towns in order to help put out fires. They don't know what they're doing, really. They don't have good equipment. It takes very serious training.
They probably just came to get a little experience.
Right. Well, no. What they really came to do is to actually create this kind of story. Mm. And in truth, the story is not that at all. The story is that jihadism, the idea to destroy Israel within the framework of jihadism, was what motivated hundreds of fires to be started by young jihadists. And the Palestinian Authority is one that teaches this idea often and very strongly through their media outlets and through their Facebook pages and through their sermons. And that's exactly what happened. And the covering of that true story with this narrative that really we're all together and one, and you see we can coexist and all we need is peace. That is a cynical usage of people's will to see good news is like that, to cover up the real truth, which is these people are completely complicit.
Right,
Palestinian authorities completely complicit with the effort to destroy Israel.
Well, Isha, I think that there were some people who bought that side of the story, and they're the kind of people who, with all the love in the world, typically buy that kind of rhetoric, which is they're, just as you said, they're really looking for that peace story. And my heart goes out to them, you know, because I get it. But I don't think that most people were totally convinced that this is just a peace story and this is just wildfires. I think people know that it was arson. I think that in this
it's terrorist arson.
Right. Oh, definitely. That it's
organized,
right, correct.
Societal terrorist arson.
That it's terrorist arson. Okay.
But like en masse, hundreds of people took part in this.
Right. I mean, certainly dozens of people took part in this. But that's enough. Do you know what I'm saying? I think dozens of people is enough to make the point.
Wait. And let's remind our listeners, Malka, that hashtag Israel is burning.
Right.
Was burning through the Twitter sphere.
Absolutely, and people were very happy.
Right.
Right. The people who were behind that were very happy. And one tweet that I saw was very interesting that I really connected to is like, they always call it Palestine, and the second that it's on fire, now it's Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was very telling, right? That it's always Palestine, but the second that it's being destroyed, now they recognize that it's Israel, because they know that they hope in their deepest heart of hearts that Israel will be destroyed, right. And that's their whole goal.
And this was really trending on Twitter. It was
right, and it made the news that it was trending on Twitter. Also, we have to maintain a clear head in these moments and to understand what our real goal is, which is, you know, if you're looking for a peace story and you're looking for a good news story, let it be that the Jewish people came together, that they supported these people in their time of need, that they outpoured with money, with clothing, with food, with old refrigerators, with...
Hey, I'm sorry,
you know,
I'm sorry.
But not
Malka,
the story.
I have to disagree with you. Like, yes, I know we're going to do that stuff.
Yes.
I know we're going to do that. I know we're going to be nice to one another and come together and all that stuff in prayer.
But that we should fight the enemy. I agree. Obviously, we should fight the enemy. But you and I were sitting here in our.
So don't give me the come together talk. We have to talk about. Everybody's going to do the come together talk because it's the easy way to deal with this. We have to talk about getting into those communities. Arab communities that are supporting jihad into their Facebook pages. We have to make arrests. We have to take
arrests
away
are happening.
Take
arrests
away
are
people's
happening.
Citizenship or residency. We have to take that away. We have to punish here.
Yes,
we have
I
to.
Agree
we have
that.
To fight fire with fire. We have to have a fire of rage that comes out of here, and that's what I'm keep on trying to talk about. We are constantly being a rage is being taken away from us. We're not allowed to rage anymore. We're not allowed to even get upset anymore. You can't even like you can't get angry. You can't say, you know. What are we going to do to avenge this? What are we going to do to get justice? What are we going to do to make sure this never happens again? Those are three different levels, okay? But we got to talk like that. Instead, it's always like, oh my God, we got to help the people, and oh my God, we came together, it's so beautiful. It's like, forget it for a second. We were just under massive attack.
That's right.
The whole country was our forests were burned down. The little animals lost their homes, and the big animals, the people, lost their homes. And it was a horrific attack of people within our, and these are, by the way, mostly Israeli Arabs.
Correct.
So let's like look at this in the face.
You're right. I looked it in the face. And now what? Now what?
Talk about it on your radio show.
Okay. Yes.
Do something that you can, whatever you can. Don't allow them to. That's why I'm talking about this as a media story. Don't allow the media to take away from us the most natural of reactions, which is rage, anger, and a will inside that says never again. Maybe the day is not here today where we can actually act on never again. Okay, maybe that's true, but we will not allow that fire inside to die down. We know what's just. We know what just happened to us. And we're not going to cover it up. We're not going to be like We're not going to be like victims of trauma who just don't want to talk about it and just want to move on. We have to say no. This was a horrible thing that happened. A great injustice. It's actually what you said right now, which is, and now what? So what am I supposed to do with my frustration? I'd rather just keep going. That is one of the ways in which the post-Zionists really operate. They create in us this feeling like the rage won't go anywhere, so you might as well just sublimate
it. You're not saying anything wrong. Everything you're saying is right. I'm saying, though, that as a regular person, as a lady sitting who has in 10 minutes some cookies to make, right? What am I supposed to do? I can't go out, even if I would really want to. I can't go out and do justice.
Okay, but at least you can write on the Times of Israel in the comment section, like, this is BS. Sometimes you have to be a little kid and call the emperor naked. You just have to, that's what you have to say. You have to say, this is a false, preposterous, backwards representation of what happened here. And I'm not going to be a part of it. That's all. I'm just not going to be a part of it. And if I have ability to tweet, Facebook, or comment on a newspaper, I mean, I feel like an American Jew. Write a letter to the editor.
Okay, that's the only sword we have.
But it's important. Sometimes you have to do that.
Hopefully, in this modern age, also, these kind of messages get to the upper echelons. And if they see that the society is behind their strong stance, then maybe they're more inclined to take a strong stance.
Right. Malka, I got to go to Hebron to do the tour. I want everybody to check out Hebron.com for both our fun site and our tour site and the informational site, which is run by my good friend Ben. And I also want to thank Ben for helping me with the show, and also Moshe, my good buddy Moshe out in Idaho, for making sure that the show gets out to the world. I want to thank you very much, Malka, for making time from your busy schedule.
Thank you for having me.
And the cookies and all the good things.
I got cookies to make. It needs to happen.
I'm
going to use fire to make cookies.
That's right. That's the way to build the Jewish future. Fight fire with fire. You're going to make some delicious cookies. And you make delicious intellectual cookies as well by being on our show today. I want to thank you. I want to ask everybody to write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Many other great shows that are here for you to connect you to the story of Israel wherever you are. Folks, there's a lot of people that want to put out our fire with their fire. They're trying to fight our fire with their fire, but our fire is going to be stronger and bigger, and it's going to be a combustion of emotion, of will, of memory, of history, of a historical moment that we will not give up. This is our time. And the way that you have to fight the fires of the jihadists and other people is by exploding with your own fire of love. Put on that flag of Israel next to your house. Put on a picture of the land of Israel in your house. Drink a bottle of wine Friday night from the land of Israel. Do whatever you can. Take a step to show the world, show yourself that you're filled with fiery, burning passion for the story of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. Malka, thank you so much for being with me.
Thanks, Yishai. I hope we have only good news next week. Amen. Have fun in Hebron.
All right, folks. More great stuff is on the way. Landofisrael.com. Stay tuned, stay strong, stay connected, and shalom.
Rabbi Isaac Nissenbaum, one of the founders of the religious Zionist Mizrahi movement, wrote, "The objective of Mizrahi is the total revival of our nation in all its aspects, to revive Judaism in our hearts and to revive our hearts for Judaism. The Land of Israel Network is powered by the Mizrahi World Movement."
Do you like picking strawberries or blueberries in the spring and summer? What about grapes? If you were to take an experience like picking grapes and move it to the heartland of Israel, this is when an experience becomes prophetic. Young and old, singles and families are all invited on this adventure of a lifetime. I'm Joshua Waller with Hayuvel, and I invite you to join us on the mountains of Israel, where prophecy meets reality. Go to hayuvel.com, that's H-A-Y-O-V-E-L.com, for more information.